Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.
Welcome back to Candidate Confessional. I'm Sam Stein, and for this week, I'm going to go solo for reasons that you will understand pretty soon. Now, back in 2006, a former North Carolina senator named John Edwards was gearing up to run for president. Along with Hillary Clinton and a first-term Illinois senator named Barack Obama, he was considered one of the main contenders for the Democratic nomination. And as part of the groundwork for his campaign, Edwards had some videos done for him that were pretty unusual for the time. Remember, it was 2006, YouTube was still brand new, and internet videos were not that major force in politics that they are today. And so the Edwards videos were a novelty. They showed the candidate in a variety of casual, off-the-cuff situations, like, for example, reclining on his campaign jet while lamenting the superficiality of politics.
I'd rather be successful or unsuccessful based on who I really am, not based on some plastic Ken doll that you put up in front of audiences. That's not me, you know?
The idea was to show the candidate in unguarded, authentic moments to give a flavor of what John was really like. And he was helped in his mission by interactions with his videographer, who joked with him from off screen.
It's a great speech.
Can you read it?
Yes, I can read it.
You can?
Yes.
Riel Hunter, the filmmaker whom Edwards had hired to produce the videos, shows up only in the first video. She interjects playfully from behind the camera. She jokes with John. You never actually see her face, but really, she makes it work.
That is a great speech.
So glad you like it.
I like it. Why don't you hear me give it live?
So, it raised some eyebrows when, in the lead-up to Edwards launching his presidential bid, those videos were suddenly scrubbed from the internet. Rumors began to circulate that the reason for this was that he had had an affair with his videographer, and the campaign wanted to scrub any evidence of their professional relationship. Now, at this point, the story gets a little personal for me, because in my early days at the Huffington Post, I was told that the reason why the videos had been removed was that John Edwards was having an affair with that videographer. And so began the process by which I became the first person to publicly speculate about the Riel Hunter-John Edwards relationship. No, I did not expose the affair. The National Enquirer is responsible for that. But back in the fall of 2007, I published a story raising questions as to why those videos had been scrubbed from the web. It wasn't my finest piece of work. In fact, I was quite petrified by it. This hadn't been the type of journalism I had envisioned doing when I entered the field. Selfishly, I thought I had tarred my career. And for a while, it felt like that was the case. Edwards denied the affair, and everyone except the National Enquirer ignored the story. Eventually, so did I. It would be many months before the truth did come out, when Edwards finally admitted that the affair had taken place, and it became known that they had had a child together. But by that point, he was no longer a presidential candidate. And although the story was major news, both he and Hunter gradually receded from public view. For years, I thought about that first story that I published, about what it meant for me and what it meant for Riel. I'd wanted to explain to her why it was that I'd written the story in the first place. Maybe, if I'm being honest, I just wanted to understand the full scope of what my piece had done. So I finally got up the courage to ask her to talk in the lead-up to this season, and she graciously agreed. But it wasn't just her story that she wanted to discuss. Instead, what we turned our attention to was what it was like to see a media firestorm build when you're squarely in the middle of it. This is Candidate Confessional.
Can you hear me?
You sound great. Wonderful. Even after a call, like, I couldn't believe it was going to happen until it actually happened.
Here we are.
Well, how do we even begin? So for the people who are going to be tuning into this podcast when it does air, I think it's what they should know is that you and I, Riel, have like a history. And I don't want to get to that off the bat. What I want to know from you, first and foremost, is like what your life was like before you became this media fascination. Who were you? What did you do? What were your passions? What were your interests? Tell us a little bit about yourself before you became a fixture of the political world.
Well, it's I didn't. How do you go that far back? I don't spend a lot of time dwelling in the past, and it seems so long ago. Do you know what's interesting, Sam? In order to speak with you, I reread my book, the first edition of my book. And I can tell you that I was blown away by how I am a completely different person than the person who wrote the book.
Well, in what ways were you different, do you think?
Oh, I was trusting. I was carefree. I was happy. I wasn't at war with anyone. I lived in a different reality.
Had you ever been politically active, for instance?
No.
Were you no?
No.
So
not very not interested in politics. No.
But then you sort of, you fell in love with John Edwards and you got kind of sucked into this world. You weren't obviously, a political operative, but you became a part of a political campaign in a way. And this is – the work you were doing was videography for the Edwards Committee at the time, and you were trying to – and you produced these web videos, and it was a lot of work, a lot of travel, just trying to make sure that the listener understands this.
And so it was – that part was really great. So it was, creatively fulfilling at the same time as misbehaving.
That is one way to describe it. And I assume in the back of your mind, your assumption was that this will never become public, that we'll just, go about and do our thing and no one will ever know.
I didn't it seems very premeditated, and when I was way too in love to be thinking about that.
That's a fair point.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking beyond today, what's going on today?
That's fascinating. All right, so now I'm going to get egocentric here. People will understand this question, why I'm asking this question a little bit, but when was the first time you heard my name?
I'm so sorry to disappoint you, Sam, but I don't remember.
All right. So the backstory, just so people know, is I think it was the fall of 2007. I wrote a story that I believe mentioned you and the videos disappearing from the internet. And I think it was the first time.
You believe it mentioned me?
It definitely mentioned you. It was the first time I think that it had been suggested that something was untoward. And I guess I have to become the subject of the interview now for a second, because and this is what brings us together, which is at the time I was a reporter at the Huffington Post for 3 months. I was petrified of writing this story. It had been assigned to me by my editors. And we wrote it without a firm conclusion about what was happening.
Wait, Sam, I have a couple questions. So
sure.
Why were you petrified?
Good question. So I was petrified because when I had started at the Huffington Post, it was my first real journalism gig. I had done internships before. But I had this notion of journalism that I would do that was lofty and aspirational and issue-oriented and policy-driven. And I would, big picture. And my first big piece was going to be an open-ended story about web videos that had been taken offline and disappeared that left the suggestion that the person who created those videos, you, may have been having an affair with the subject of the videos, John Edwards. And it felt like I was selling out. It also felt in a way like, who cares? Like, this doesn't really matter in the end, because it has nothing to do with, what John Edwards would mean for this country. And is it fair to drag this person into this whole saga? And so when I put up the story, all my fears were confirmed. The amount of hate mail I got was insane. There was a poll put up on, I believe, Daily Coast that said 84% of respondents believed I was a hack. 16% thought it was responsible journalism. And I went into a bit of depression. I thought, wow, I've set a reputation for myself that is, poor and I'll never recover from. And, you know, all for what? For a piece that I couldn't even confirm. Now, I had no idea what you were thinking on the other side. I could imagine probably much worse than I was.
So your intention – can I ask you a question? So your intention when you first wrote it was to point to or bring up the fact or the assumption or the question, was he having an affair?
We had been chasing a rumor at that time that an affair was happening. And we had it fairly well sourced. I mean, it wasn't 100%. And we had hit a roadblock. Like, we couldn't obviously confirm it. It would be a year or so till it was confirmed. And so we had a question. The question we faced was, do we just kill it and not say anything? Or do we put up what we have? And do we write a piece that recounts the steps that we took from a reporting standpoint to get to that roadblock? And there was an internal debate about what to do, and we obviously decided to do a very sort of introspective piece about our own reporting, and it left an open-ended question that probably in retrospect was – I don't know if I would do it again, honestly. It's tough. It's a tough question. It still haunts me to this day whether it was the right thing to do journalistically.
It's so interesting because I reread the
Oh,
piece.
God, it's terrible. Don't.
But what's
don't.
So fascinating to me, Sam, is that you – this happens all the time in life and especially in the media. When the thing that you're accusing someone of, you're actually doing yourself. And so I found
Go on.
It so
– What do you mean by that?
I found it so fascinating the way that you wrote that piece is as if you were so, you know, the innocent one assigned in look at these webisodes. You were doing a piece about the webisodes, never disclosing that, you know, we have these rumors.
Yeah.
So you were covering yourself as you're accusing the campaign of covering themselves.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, totally. And there was no shortage of hypocrisy on my point. Now,
always so fascinating to me.
Yeah, I would say to my credit in that case, like the campaign I thought deserved or had an obligation to be more forthcoming. And they probably should have been more forthcoming. Whereas, you know, my job is not to necessarily, you know, be, you know, an open book about my own motivations. My job is to report what I can find. But I don't discount your point. You absolutely have a point, and that's part of the reason why the piece actually like really plagued me, which is I felt really like I had done something almost wrong journalistically.
That brings up another point though, because I think that shame, because those are feelings of shame that it's like I think the whole thing about the being at war with the media is shame based, because the media is always at this rush to uncover what's hidden, and to be the first one. And the flip of that coin is the involuntary exposure of something that you don't want exposed, and that's shame based. And so I find that to be extremely fascinating, to be the root of what's going on with, you know, the battle.
Well, let me ask you then, because at that point in time, you know, there was – as soon as my piece came out, like, they circled the wagons. Nothing was going on. This was irresponsible. How dare the Huffington Post put this out in print? And that sort of definitely caused me shame, as you know. But I'm wondering from your perspective, like, did you think it was being handled well by the campaign? And what were you thinking? Like, what did you want to do at that moment?
I didn't want to be exposed because I was pregnant. And I was more concerned about the safety of my daughter and what was going to happen with that. I had no desire to be anywhere near the media or anywhere near anyone, for that matter. I wanted to be in peace and harmony because I was bringing a life into the world.
And I'm assuming the circus started instantaneously after that, people coming to your house asking for comment and so on.
That afternoon.
the National Enquirer was knocking at the door at 4 o'clock that afternoon.
Wow.
Which started my run and my trauma. Because I didn't want to be exposed, and I was terrified yeah. of being exposed, which was not good.
So that brings me to the point. That brings me to the point of this podcast. So this is a podcast mostly about people in politics who experience defeat or loss. And the reason I wanted to have you on is because there's an underbelly to that, which is, you know, you can be a non-candidate and you could suffer defeat and loss. And in one instance, in your instance, what I mean by that is that you could be sort of chewed up and spit out by the political entertainment media complex, and you can end up for the worse or you can end up for the better. So tell me a little bit about what life is like when you have reporters hanging out on your front lawn, the National Enquirer banging at your door, and everyone essentially chasing you, your family, your friends for parcels of information that could confirm a rumor that would upend an entire campaign.
It feels like harassment. I mean, when people camp out on your lawn and they won't leave you alone and they won't go away, it's like bullying. It's harassment. It doesn't feel good. No one respects your boundaries. It doesn't feel good. And I didn't want to talk. If I wanted to talk, I would have, you know, been front and center talking.
What was the worst thing that happened in terms of the way reporters or media outlets treated you?
What? It's a long list, Sam.
We have a lot of time here, so let's go through it.
The bullying that goes on, the coming to your house is a violation, a complete violation, and camping out. But then being so sweet and nice and spinning it and shaming you, framing everything as though you're a complete idiot and they're so smart and brilliant.
What precautions did you have to take to avoid the media?
Well, I didn't take enough.
Fair enough.
It's still, Sam, I kid you not, someone knocked on my door yesterday and my heart started racing.
Really?
Yeah. A week or two weeks ago, a tabloid reporter knocked on my door, which started, I really thought I was over all of the trauma. Apparently,
damn.
I'm not.
Did you ever, like, you know, think about just coming out with it and saying, I can't handle this anymore and I just want to, like, tell my story and then move on?
In hindsight, I think that I should have done a lot of things differently. I was the most concerned about my daughter.
Yes.
So first and foremost, what was best for her? And I really did not want her father to be upset about anything. So I wanted to keep the peace so they would have a shot of having a relationship. So the media was pressure on me, constant pressure. I think if I had done everything differently, yeah, things would have been different.
No, yeah, and it's not – the point of this is not to rehash that. I'm sort of more interested in what it's like to be, as they say, in the barrel and trying to, like, work through your different options in that moment. But you're right. Like, the first
it's
person
not
out
fun,
with a narrative.
Sam,
no, I don't deny that. I don't deny that.
Believe
and
you don't want to be. It's your yeah. your side's a lot more enjoyable. Being the probably so. Being the one chasing as opposed to the one being hunted.
Yeah, and you were hunted for a while. It wasn't like the, you know, weeks after my story wrote that everything came out. What ended up happening, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the National Enquirer published a story about a week after my first piece. And I think that was the most for the first actually direct allegation of an affair. And then they kind of stayed on it, but everyone else sort of didn't. And then it was only in the summer, so almost a year after or 9 months after my first story, that ABC News broke the story.
Yeah, the National Enquirer apparently ended up stalking me via satellite.
No.
They never gave up on that.
Well, they're relentless. We'll give them that.
They were relentless, and they had the resources to be relentless.
Yes. Did you – before I get to how it felt when it finally broke, I'm just curious. Did you begin to – distrust people around you as the Inquirer and others kept inquiring? Did your circle of friends and family become tighter?
I stopped talking about anything except with my attorney.
And it changed me in the way I was so open before. You know, just like if you go to the grocery store and you're talking to the checkout clerk. It altered me. And I would like to change that. I would like to learn how to communicate without fear.
Well, that's why this podcast is the first step. we're going to bring you back, Rael. So when the story does break, what percentage of you is finally relieved and what percentage of you is just purely panicked?
I was not relieved because it was only a half truth. And I was thrown under the bus. I mean, there were many, many, many problems with the way it came out, the story.
The one that John Edwards told.
Yeah, because it wasn't accurate. So I wasn't freed. The truth did not set me free because it wasn't the truth.
Fair enough.
It complicated things even further.
Which gets to your point about how you want to be the first one to tell the story.
Correct.
And so what did you do afterwards? I mean, when you see something like that, that completely, in your estimation, distorts reality, and it just adds another element, another chapter to what is, you know, already a very distorted book.
But the media distorted a lot too. And it was infuriating to me.
Yeah. You mentioned, I mean, it's dark. You said you feel like you want to die. Did you ever, don't even know if I should ask this, but did you ever like have thoughts about hurting yourself, or is that just
No. I love life. I love life. I was saying to my daughter the other day, there was a bad day. I said, a bad day is better than no day. You know, I absolutely am a huge survivor and I have a huge love of life.
Sure.
And curiosity. I love, even though they're challenging times, I take whatever comes to learn and grow and change what's inside of me that created the circumstances.
Just to back up, and then I'm going to leave the actual story to talk more about politics and media with you. But just to back up, I'm wondering if you could take me in specifics, like that moment where John Edwards sat down for the ABC interview.
For months, he said the story was completely untrue, ridiculous, and false.
In which he misrepresented a lot of the story.
I know that it's not possible that this child could be mine because of the timing of events. So I know it's not possible. Happy to take a paternity test and would love to see it happen.
Where were you? How did you watch it?
I was in St. Croix. Quinn and I had taken, my daughter Quinn, and I had taken a private plane to St. Croix, maybe to move there or live there. I wanted away. I wanted away from all of it. The media circus, I was really being hunted at that point by everybody. And I was in St. Croix. It was late at night. I was in a hotel. And Quinn had just fallen, tiny baby, she's a few months old, or February, you know, I don't, to August, 6 months old, less than 6 months. And I watched it on the phone with my lawyer. And the bed, I remember the bed was like, the mattress had, you would sink down in the middle of it. So it was like we were sinking down in the middle of this mattress.
She literally and figuratively.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, it's a perfect reflection of my circumstances. And it was just the two of us. And I was on the phone with my lawyer.
And what were you thinking?
There aren't... It's beyond surreal. it is. I can't describe it because it's otherworldly.
Yeah.
I remember the first time it hit me... this was in my book, so I remembered it. But John was at a debate, and Hillary Clinton was talking to him about how she didn't have anything to do with the Rael Hunter story, and he was telling me this, and I couldn't get over the fact that Hillary Clinton knew my name.
It's like, what? Like, it really stopped me. Like, I couldn't, what? My world had collided. So it's unusual when you are, you know, walking through an airport and everyone recognizes you. And then you become paranoid. I mean, and then people, even after the fact, like, how do I know you? I know you. You know, it's
odd.
Yeah, it still happens. It's weird.
Wow. I can't imagine to go from
so it's just back to your question. It's just it was a surreal experience.
Yeah. So what did you – I mean, obviously your opinions of the media are not necessarily the highest opinions, and I can understand why. But what did you learn about the media and political media and specifically through the process?
I don't understand why you do what you do. And I would like to understand it. I really would. I don't understand your perspectives.
Sometimes I don't either.
Like, I don't understand the agendas. Why the moral authority thing? You know, it's like I don't get it. Like, who makes you guys the moral authority? Like, I don't understand. Like,
let me take a stab at your mean, which is that a number of people in my world probably are, have committed adultery, cheated on their spouses, and then write with incredulity about your story.
Yes. Or sit there and interview me. You know, they can interview me and they're like, oh, don't be, you know, we understand, we feel for you, we've all done it. And the minute the cameras go on, they attack me. Like, no one says that on camera. And then they attack me as though they didn't just say that 5 minutes ago.
Do you think that part of it, this is not about you, but part of it, I'm trying to explain how I would rationalize this, which is... people in my profession aren't candidates for office, right? We're not presenting ourselves as family men. And in case of John Edwards, you know, his wife was dying of cancer. You know,
but
there was
I was single. I wasn't married. And, you know, it's granted, I shouldn't have done that. But really? It has to be all my fault?
Did you feel like people made it your fault? See, I never actually thought of it that way. Maybe I'm different than people, but I mean, you obviously had some fault, right? But like, I thought that the onus was on him. Like, he was the one who was presenting himself that way. He was the one who presented his marriage in that way. He was the one who was telling voters to vote at him because of a certain perception that they had. And, you know.
Yeah, but I think great majority of the media, it's a double standard. You know, as a woman, I should have, you know, I
you should have stayed away.
Yeah. I shouldn't
have. Do you think, yeah.
I'm responsible. I'm so powerful. I've really been accused of almost bringing down the Democratic Party. You know, that I'm so powerful. I'm really, there's some, from women, women. Women are ruthless to each other.
I was just going to say there is something about the women on women element of this that, you know, and I think they saw this in the Lewinsky saga too, where women almost instinctively defended Bill Clinton at the time and attacked Monica. And it was just like, in retrospect, it seemed really antiquated. And I think we sort of reconsidered that type of coverage and our perceptions of Bill Clinton too. But my point in asking this was not necessarily to get into the gender elements of this, but to sort of get into the cannibalism of the media. I mean, when there's a story, they just want to consume it like that. And did you have any inkling that it was going to be like that? Do you think – I mean, as someone who was the meal, you know, you were the meal, what was it
no,
like?
No, it was – and I think it was just a perfect storm.
Yeah,
you know, it just had all the elements.
It was too good. It was just too good to not jump at. But don't you think that says something about political press? Like, you know, we got – by the time it happened, he wasn't even, by the time it was revealed, he wasn't even a candidate. And yet we were still obsessed with it.
Well, it had all the elements. That's why it's more interesting, you know.
Yeah.
It's more interesting than healthcare, you know, or whatever the latest.
Speak for yourself, Rial. I love healthcare.
You know, whatever your war is, your current daily war that you're having with the other with the other side, or with our current president, who is you know, the other side. It's, you know, sex is more interesting. Sex it and is. Betrayal is juicier.
So do you since this all happened, how long did it take for, I mean, life will never be normal again. Obviously you still have people coming to your yard and recognizing you in airports, but like how long did it take you to get towards
normal? Go ahead.
No, I'm just curious how long the recovery process has taken and what it's been like.
Sam, I've never been normal, so I can't imagine I'm ever going to have a normal life. Normal is, you know, relative.
Sure, fair enough.
So I'm creative, and I have a show I'm working on, a documentary right now. So I'm hoping to heal my relationship with the media because I would like my show to be successful.
You're going to become one of us. It's bound to happen. You might as well just enter journalism.
I don't know about becoming one of you, but I would like to be friends. I would like to have a working relationship that's based in trust and honesty and integrity. Do you think that's possible?
No. Get out. So have you like watched any stories since your own story and been like, ooh, I recognize that, or ooh, like that reminds me of, you know, what I went through, or God, I wish they could have read my book and taken my advice?
I watched you go after our president every single day, and it's amazing that I end up taking his side a lot of the time because it's...
You say you mean me specifically or the media at large?
The media at large.
Okay, thank you. I didn't know if you were directing
this directly.
While he
was running, you know, everyone thought he was a big joke.
Yeah.
And I didn't think he was a big joke from the get-go.
So you felt empathetic?
I feel empathy for him every single day.
Go on. Explain this.
Being at war with the media is, he's just one guy. It's the entire pack against him. And he has valid points. He really does.
Did you vote for Donald Trump?
I did not, but I really, really like him, and I'm in awe of his tenacity and his ability to function while everyone is attacking him.
Don't you think he kind of likes it, though?
I don't see how he does it. What?
I think he likes it. That's the difference. I think
he
loves being at the center of it.
I agree with you 100%. I was pushing back against it, which hurts when you know, fighting it. And you've got to come to terms with it somehow. And he really does. He's a master at getting attention. And flipping it and using it to his advantage. No, he really is. And he speaks that. I mean, his accusations of saying fake news, which I understand what he's saying, but he says it in a way that's polarizing and attention grabbing, which ends up serving him, but he does have a point.
Yeah, no, he definitely is at the center of the firestorm. The difference, I would argue, is that he builds the firestorm, whereas you built it but kind of like didn't want to build it. He actively goes out and says, you know what, cover me, throw your grenades at me, you know, bring it on. And then he turns it into his own political advantage.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It really is. He's the master at it. I mean, he really is.
Yeah, he is. No, I don't disagree. Beyond Donald Trump, I'm curious, did you feel empathy for Hillary Clinton?
I am also in awe of her, yes, and feel great empathy for her. And it's interesting because I never felt that she, you know, the email thing and the things that happened in the last few weeks or 10 days or whatever it was with the FBI and the emails and really buried her. And I think it has to do with, I've looked at this a lot, and I think it has to do with our own feelings. Like when we have our own issues with what the media is reporting, it sticks to us. So like John, if you remember, had that $400 haircut that almost buried him because the part of him agreed with what the media was saying. So I think that if you have some sort of contradicting internal conflict going on, it sinks you. Is it like so? So the media coming at you, it'll stick to you and it buries you and it causes you depression and you can't get past it because you agree with some of it. But if you're like Donald Trump and he lives in his own reality and he sticks to his reality and he manifests that reality. He gets it done because he doesn't let anything stick to him. Or he's better at it than he's better at it than the rest of us. He just really is able to shield your thoughts and feelings or whatever, you know, everyone else is saying, and stick to his own agenda.
I totally agree with that. He's Teflon and he doesn't let it bother him. And he doesn't care if, you know, you think like he's contradicted himself or if he's stepped in it. He just moves on.
Well, we do that. We contradict ourselves all the time. It's human.
Yeah, of course.
It's
my point is that
and we change
is that
our
most
opinions all the time. So why is that wrong? It's very human.
My point is this, which is that most people instinctively would be like, I didn't contradict myself, or, you know, that $400 haircut is justifiable for this reason, or, you know, so on and so forth. And I feel like Donald Trump would be like, yeah, I fucking got a $400 haircut. I'm rich. You know, it's like, and he would be unapologetic about it.
And actually it was $1,400. So there. And everybody should be able to afford a $1,400 haircut, and I'm going to help you make that happen.
That would be how we would do it, yes. And people would be like, yeah, I want a $1,400 haircut too. Hell yeah. Trump's right.
Yeah. He's great at it.
All right, I have two last questions for you, and then I'll let you ask me questions as you've been doing throughout this podcast, turning it on me, which shows that you will become a journalist at one point in your life. It's just a matter of time. My first question is this.
Isn't it much more interesting, though, to have a conversation as opposed to just the way I see the world? I mean, I really think that that's part of the issue with the media. They don't allow everyone's perspectives.
Well, that's why I made this podcast. So here's my two-part question. Back to the Monica Lewinsky story. When that was happening, I'm sort of curious what your perception of it was at the time.
My perception of Monica Lewinsky?
Yeah, when that whole thing was happening with Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, or pick any other political affair that happened, you know, obviously, you know, you followed politics even if not closely. And I'm wondering, like, as, you know, past political affairs were happening, like Monica or the Gary Hart instance or whatever affair you want to talk about, you certainly must have like had a perception of it or consumed that news in a way and never thought that you would be in that position. I'm not saying it's a direct parallel, but you probably never thought you'd be like, oh, I'm going to be in that position one day in my life. And when you were, did you look back at like Monica, for instance, or anyone else and say, wow, I have a totally different, you know, understanding of what she went through?
No. I never really compared myself to anyone. I had a great amount of empathy for Monica because she was so young and the whole government invading. When the government's involved, it's a whole different deal. It's not just the media. It's the government. And that, I mean, my heart just bleeds for her. Yeah, that's at that young age. It's that talk about a firestorm.
Yeah, she was. People don't realize how young she was. I mean, she was what, like 22, maybe?
Yeah, very young. Story was just so different because, you know, I was 40 and in love, and it was we have a child. You know, it's a very different relationship.
Okay, then let me ask one last question. this will happen again, right? Like, it's not like what you did is crazy or shocking when you think about it. People have affairs, especially politicians. And at some point down the road, someone else will have an affair. It will become a huge media firestorm. And we'll go through this circus all over again. Before we do that, what would your advice be to the people who are in the heart of it? And what would your pleas be, the pleas that you would make to journalists covering it?
Well, you know, don't do it, first of all. Don't go there. Don't do it or get your book deal first.
That's actually pretty good advice to end on.
Be the first one to get the book deal.
Fair enough.
And the other thing is, make sure you get a lot of money for the interview. Because, you know, it's like, oh, we don't pay for interviews. It's like the thing about the media is for some reason they're allowed to profit and nobody else is. You know, it's I don't agree with that either. I think that everyone should be making a living off of their own story.
Fair enough.
You're going to be profiting from, you know, their story, they should be profiting from their story.
Some outlets pay, some don't. There's some shame.
Like, there's some, like weird shame about how dare you make money off of your own life.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds. Like the breathable, silky smooth tree dasher, the responsive foam and extra grip of the tree runner, or the classic low-top look of the tree piper. Allbirds has a lightweight, ultra-packable shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet-setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
That's a fair point. All right. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I know it was a long time in the making. I actually really enjoyed this conversation. I wish we had done it sooner because, you know, our histories are intertwined in a way, but also because the issues are kind of cool and interesting to talk about.
And where do you go from here, Sam?
It's a really good question. I don't know.
Would you report on another affair?
Oh, wow. That's an actually fascinating question. I've had the opportunity to pursue stories on other affairs. And I've passed on them. Once is definitely enough. Once might have been too many. I think there is. It depends on the situation. I think in your situation, if I had to do it over again, I don't know if I would have done it. I certainly wouldn't have done it the same way. But I do think there was merit to the story. I don't think there's merit to the way the story was told. I think there's merit to the story in that, for all the reasons I laid out, which was John was presenting a life that was not true. And he was, in that sense, misleading voters. I'm not trying to claim moral high ground here. I just think that there's news there of value to the public. But I don't think that's necessarily the case with every affair. And I don't necessarily think that every affair is something that the public needs to know about. And I certainly am open to the notion that, we live in glass houses. Like, people in my profession are no less noble. So it's tough. It's a tough question. I find it weird. I don't find it weird. I just find it interesting that, you know, we still are so fascinated by these stories. Obviously, you note sex sells, and I don't disagree with that. But, you know, you would think as a society we would sort of get more comfortable with the idea that this isn't necessarily the biggest public interest story of all time. And I don't know if we're there yet.
Yeah, I also think that there's, you know, in politics especially, and I think Donald Trump has changed this, and I think that's a great thing about guarding your public persona. You know, everyone wants to be perceived in such a great light, in a perfect light. instead of a human light. You know, we're all human. And so there's this, you know, protection about they want people want to be loved instead of shamed.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of a politician who's like been just basically said, yeah, I had an affair, it was terrible, or it wasn't me, or I regret it, or it was a human instinct, but it doesn't matter to my campaign because my campaign is not about my personal life.
And I think
I don't think I've ever seen someone do that.
No, it hasn't, but I think that's the direction we're headed into.
You do?
Because I think we're evolving into that.
Well, when that happens, when someone makes that point, I will call you back and we will have another interview. All right.
Okay, Sam.
That was Riel Hunter. Now, Candidate Confessional is produced and edited by Zach Young, who also wrote our theme music. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your podcast platform of choice and spread the word. Next week, we have Tom Perriello to talk about the 2017 Virginia governor's race and the future for the Democratic Party in the age of Trump. See you then.